Hello, this is Daryl Castle with today's podcast. Today is Monday, March 23rd, 2015. And on today's podcast, we're going to discuss Islam and the Islamic State, and specifically, what would motivate a young American to leave his family and his country and join the Islamic State, an organization whose primary MO is barbaric cruelty. The New York Times, in the Sunday, March 22nd edition, published on its front page the story of a young man who calls himself Abdi Nur, Mr. Nur, barely out of high school, and from Minneapolis, Minnesota, dreamed of being a basketball player, but Islam intervened in his life. He underwent a conversion to Islam. So that's where it starts. It starts with Islam. He is very active, Mr. Nur, that is, very active on Facebook from his newfound home in Syria, teaching English, trading gun tips, holding an AK-47 and smiling, praising his, quote, amazing brothers. When his American friends ask, "Who brainwashed you?" he said, "The words of Allah and the Quran." So, he understands the Quran. He understands it to say what it actually says, which is, kill those who will not convert to Islam, make war on those who do not believe. But he joins a group that takes the Quran's direction one step further. The Islamic State interprets the Quranic directive as a license to commit continuing acts of savagery, beheadings, burnings, slavery, child kidnapping, child rape, and the like. Mr. Nair joins these people, and he calls them, quote, amazing brothers. Mr. Nair is just one example. There are many, many others, including women. I guess the idea of being owned as chattel property, of being someone's sex slave, somehow appeals to them. Since 2013, according to the New York Times, 29 people in the United States have been charged or detained as juveniles on allegations of supporting the Islamic State, usually after trying to travel to Syria. 24 others are believed to be with the Islamic State in Syria or have been killed in the fighting. Apparently, recruiters are operating in the United States, preying on vulnerable young people, directions of what to pack up, who to contact, where to go, along with the stories of others, are freely posted online. Islam then has a lot to answer for, a lot besides international terrorism, if that's not enough. The American government must also answer for unfettered Islamic immigration and stoking the fires by continually refusing to address the real problem and publicly admit, at least, who we are fighting. Mr. Ayan Hirsi Ali, writing in this weekend's edition of the Wall Street Journal, tells us that there are five precepts, in his opinion, precepts central to Islam, that have made it resistant to historical change. And these five things require amendment, he says. They must be changed. Number one, Muhammad's semi-divine status, along with the literalist reading of the Quran. He says Muhammad should not be seen as infallible. But I ask, wouldn't this deny the real true power of Islam as a religion? In Christianity, only apostates deny the divinity of Jesus. Without the divinity of Jesus, there is no Christianity. But he says the Quran's external spiritual values must be separated from the cultural accidents of the place and time of its birth. Number two, the supremacy of life after death. The supremacy of life after death, he says, must be amended. Thus, the appeal to martyrdom will fade. Number three, Sharia, the vast body of religious legislation. Muslims must put human law above the aspects of Sharia that are violent, intolerant, or anachronistic. Well, I would argue here that Mr. Ali really doesn't understand religion if he expects true believers to put human law above Sharia. Well, number four, the right of individual Muslims to enforce Islamic law. That should be amended. No religious police, he says. No political clerics. The imperative to wage jihad or holy war. That's number five. The imperative to wage jihad or holy war. Religion of peace and not of the sword must be the new Islam. Well, I wish Mr. Ali all the best with his five precepts. It seems, though, that it would make Islam into just a tradition while denying any divine power, much like Reform Judaism has done. Mr. Ali does admit, though, that we have to face facts. Islam is not a religion of peace, he says. He points out that, according to the International Institute for Strategic Studies, at least 70% of all fatalities in armed conflicts around the world last year were involving Muslims. To this point, it would be fair to say that Muslims have not responded kindly to suggestions of amending their religion, as Mr. Ali says. But some Muslims are at least starting to debate the role that Islam plays in violence. Traditional Muslims interpret jihad as mandating offensive holy war. That's the way they see it. They say the religion of the sword is so profuse in Islam, only a heretic would argue otherwise. Some more modern clerics are trying to refute such views by arguing that jihad does not mean holy war, but striving to achieve peace in the name of Allah. That's what Mr. Ali teaches, but he admits he is no longer a believer. One proponent of this view seems to be the current president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Mr. el-Sisi, an army officer who attended the United States Army Infantry School at Fort Benning, Georgia, as well as the U.S. Army War College, Mr. el-Sisi is apparently a devout Muslim, but also a political reformer. He wants friendly relations with Israel and with the United States, and he has rejected the, quote, death to America rhetoric voiced this past week by Iranian leader Ayatollah Khomeini at the very stage of nuclear negotiations in the final moments. Mr. al-Sisi appears to be a bright spot in a religion of violence, a religion of war, a religion of brutality and cruelty. Let's hope his view spreads. Finally, folks, I agree with Mr. Ali. Islam is not a religion of peace. There is some hope out there, but it seems to be a long, long way off. At least that's the way I see it. Until next time, this is Darrell Castle. Thanks for listening.